joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Drill, baby, drill was a rallying cry for some on the right during the presidential campaign. But yesterday, it was President Obama's turn. He proposed lifting a long-standing ban on offshore drilling off the East Coast, in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and beyond the northern shores of Alaska. Joining me to talk about the economic benefits, the environmental risks, and political implications of the decision, Stephen Power. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Rayola Dewar, she's senior economic advisor for the American Petroleum Institute. And Ethan Manuel, he's director for the Lands Protection Program of the Sierra Club. I hope you'll join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Before we begin the conversation with our guests here in the studio, we're joined by David Hayes. He's Deputy Secretary of the Department of the Interior. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Diane. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Tell us what the rationale is behind this decision.
Well, the rationale, Diane, was that, as the president explained yesterday, we need a comprehensive energy policy that focuses, as the administration has, on greatly expanding renewable energy sources, and we're putting a lot of focus on solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, et cetera. But we also need to think about our conventional oil and gas resources from an energy security perspective, and in the transition to the clean energy economy, we want to have as much carefully and environmentally sound domestic production as we can. And the Department of the Interior, under its obligations under the law, is at a place where we had to make some decisions about what areas are appropriate for additional exploration and consideration, and that's what we did yesterday.
Realistically, what's the potential for vast oil supplies?
We should start with the point the president made yesterday, which is that our global contribution to oil and gas is limited. We have about 3% of the world's reserves. So we are not going to change that here. But there are some significant additions to our domestic supply that are possible, with probably the most important in the relatively near term, being in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. It's well known that there are reserves of 3 to 4 billion barrels in an area that is well off the Florida coast, but that is currently not available. And we are going to kick off an evaluation that would look at potential development in that area.
And David, I'm sure you recognize the extent to which you have angered a number of former supporters by this decision. For example, on the New Jersey coast, Frank Lautenberg, Robert Menendez, you're going to perhaps pay a political cost for this decision.
Yes, Diane, but I think there's a lot of misinformation about yesterday's decision, which is one of the reasons I'm so delighted you're having this program. Just very quickly, for example, on the East Coast, we are not even looking at, much less scheduling, anything north of Delaware. So New Jersey all the way up to the Canadian border is not going to be part of an area of consideration. We are looking at, from an environmental perspective, we're going to kick off an environmental review process for the mid and South Atlantic coasts, but no decisions have been made to go forward with any specific leasing. there is one area off the coast of Virginia that we are going to kick off a special environmental investigation of to make a decision next year about whether it's appropriate to drill. But the point is we're going to be driven by good science, by good environmental considerations, and there's also not enough information known about the resource on the East Coast. We're going to look at that as well. One final point, a very important point, we're taking a very cautious approach, not only there, but in Alaska, where the president has taken off the table completely Bristol Bay, a presidential proclamation. That's a hugely important, pristine fishery resource up there. And we're slowing down in the Arctic. We have canceled 4 leases in the Arctic Ocean, and we're commissioning a special science review. We're going to take a careful science-driven approach to whether it makes sense to do additional oil and gas leasing offshore in the Arctic.
When you say a science-driven approach, talk about the environmental controls that you believe will be put into place. Will they work alongside those people who may be doing the drilling, the searching, the exploration?
Yes, Diane. You know, the first step really in the science-driven approach is to decide where it makes sense to drill at all. And we're open to considering new areas, but again, we're going to look at whether there some of these areas are simply too sensitive to do drilling at all. To your point about once the drilling begins, what are we requiring in terms of technology, spill response, capability, et cetera? The president already in the fiscal year 11 budget that we presented to Congress would step up inspections and enforcement of our offshore resources. We will demand the best of technology.
Okay, and so far we've been talking about offshore drilling.
Mm-hmm.
What about gas drilling in the Pennsylvania, New York area? My husband and I happen to own a farm in the northeastern tip of Pennsylvania. We have received numerous asks for the mineral rights to our property, which we would never give up. But I understand from other concerned farmers in the area who have such properties that the water has been so contaminated in those areas by the gas drilling through shale that you've got communities that can no longer drink the water. What kinds of precautions can you take there?
Well, it's a very important point, Diane. I'm actually a native of Western New York State, which has the same formation, this Marcellus Shale formation, that's of great interest. The administration is very interested and concerned about this issue. EPA has kicked off a study of the fracking process to determine whether there are water quality issues. It's an EPA lead. We're at the Department of the Interior interested in this issue because some of these techniques are being used on the public lands, and we're taking a very hard look. There's a tremendous gas resource, but like all of our resources, we've got to take a very environmentally cautious and sound approach to developing it.
I'd be interested in your assessment of the risks versus the benefits that you are taking environmentally, economically, and politically with this decision.
In terms of the oil and gas drilling more generally, Diane?
Yes, indeed.
Well, it is a balancing of all of these things. I will say that our touchstone is, first of all, environmental considerations. We're not going to go forward with a plan that puts important resources at risk. Secondly, we do want to identify the areas that have significant potential and see if we can develop them, particularly where there already is infrastructure. The Eastern Gulf is a terrific example of that because we are already getting about a third of our domestic oil and gas resources from the Central and Western Gulf. But there are some areas like the coast of California, Washington State, Oregon, the Northeast, we've taken off the table. Bristol Bay in Alaska, we've taken off the table. The Arctic Ocean, we're taking a go-slow approach because we need to, for all of our natural resources, we need to take a measured, careful, science-driven approach. And that's part and parcel of the program that the president announced yesterday.
And finally, as you're focusing on all of these oil and gas prospects, possibilities, are you going to put equal amounts of energy and resources into solar, wind, nuclear? What are your thoughts?
Absolutely, and that's something the president emphasized as his frame yesterday. We have moved out as an administration very aggressively on renewable energy. By way of example, when we came into office last year, there was no development of solar power on the public lands, despite the fact we have 500 million acres, much of it in sun-drenched deserts in the Southwest. We've been pushing very hard, working with all stakeholders to find the right places to put solar power. We expect to have between 5 and 9,000 megawatts of new solar power on public lands announced within the next 12 to 24 months. That's the equivalent of 30 medium-sized coal-fired power plants. We're pushing very hard, but doing so with stakeholders, our mantra is right from the start. We want to get these renewable energy facilities put in the right places, but adding in a material way to our energy mix.
Well, good luck to you, David Hayes. He's Deputy Secretary of the Department of the Interior. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Diane.
That you've heard from the Department of the Interior. Here in the studio, Stephen Power of the Wall Street Journal, Rayola Dewar of the American Petroleum Institute, and Ethan Manuel of the Sierra Club. They're here in the studio with me now to continue our conversation about the president's decision to go forward with offshore drilling. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Stephen Power, from your perspective, was this a purely political decision?
Well, if you look at what President Obama has said over time, his position on offshore drilling has been a somewhat complicated one and one that's somewhat evolved over time. In the 2008 presidential campaign, when John McCain called for lifting the federal moratorium on offshore drilling, the Obama campaign came out very strongly against that, criticizing Senator McCain and sort of ridiculing that idea. After a few weeks, when it became clear that public opinion was more on the side of increased exploration, as gas prices were rising to $4 a gallon, the president said he would support increased offshore drilling as long as it's part of a balanced energy portfolio that includes support for renewable energy, electric vehicles, that sort of thing. And so the announcement that he made yesterday, if you take him at his word, is consistent at least with the campaign rhetoric.
And what are some of the ramifications implications of that decision?
Well, politically, the big picture here is that President Obama is trying to pass a climate bill, a bill to put a price on carbon. And to do that, he's going to need some Republican support because the Democratic Party lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers from the industrial Midwest and energy-producing states are very leery of that, and there are going to be some Democratic defections, some clearly. And so he's going to need to pick up some Republican support. And some Republicans are making clear that in order to get support for an energy bill, it's going to have a title on oil and gas and increased exploration. So this move appears to be a signal that he is going to move in that direction to compromise on this issue. And I think that is sort of the bigger picture going forward.
Stephen Power, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Rayola Dewar, what are the U.S. energy demands expected in the next decade?
Well, we're going to go fairly slowly as we move forward, but we consume right now about 19.5 million barrels a day of oil. So we're going to need a lot more oil and energy future. Right now, it accounts for about 37% of what we consume. In 20 years or so, it's expected to account for about 33%. I think even with really rapid ramp up in renewable fuels, for example, the Department of Energy is calling for a 300% increase in ethanol and biofuels moving into our future. 85% of our transportation needs are still going to be met by oil. But we have great potential, too, when it comes to natural gas, developing more natural gas offshore and onshore, as you mentioned before, and can shift some of that to our bigger fleets, to our buses and trucks. So I think we have a lot of promise here domestically to develop these resources, and this is an important step forward, opening these areas for development.
Rayola Dewar of the American Petroleum Institute, Ethan Manuel of the Sierra Club, you see this as far more of a political decision than an economic one?
Well, I think we do. I think if you were really serious about trying to craft a modern 21st century energy policy, you would not look for that policy off of our coasts. We just don't think that trade-off is worthwhile. The resources expected off of our coast are limited, but then we risk the threat of spills and pollution that could damage beaches and coastlines, but also coastal economies, which are huge economic engines here in the United States, billion-dollar industry, support hundreds of thousands of jobs. So we just don't think the trade-off is worth it. We like a lot of the stuff. I mean, we contrast that with what Mr. Obama is doing on cars and just the announcements he's made this week.
And today, this afternoon, there's going to be a new announcement on standards there.
No, exactly right, on clean car standards and the electrification of the federal fleet that he announced yesterday. Those things will save much more oil and gas than is thought to be off of our coasts. So we like that approach, where it's focused on innovation, green technologies, and reindustrializing the country around clean energy, rather than looking backwards towards an energy policy that we think just doesn't work when you look at how much oil and gas is thought to be off of our coasts.
But at the same time, as Stephen Power has said, perhaps as a political move to gain more Republican votes for his climate change legislation, wouldn't you be in favor of that?
Well, that is true. I mean, he needs to put this on the table to bring Republicans into negotiations to get over 60 votes. As we all know, the Senate threshold is 60 to end debate and come up, have a cloture vote. So that is, we understand the need to put that on the table because we do want this climate bill to pass. We think it's important to put a cap on, a price on carbon and start reducing our emissions here in the United States.
And yet, Rayola, you believe that there are large estimates for recoverable energy going forward.
Especially in our natural gas resources, we have a lot of energy, and we didn't know even a few years ago we had, that we can bring technology to bring these resources to market. We have over 100-year supply minimum of natural gas at today's rate of consumption moving forward. We didn't know that a few years ago. We were looking at plans to import a lot of natural gas. So the technology is advancing. This is a wonderful fuel, and we ought to be going for all of these resources. We're going to need everything we can to fuel this economy moving forward. And this is a great advantage. For every barrel we can produce, every cubic foot of natural gas helps our balance of payments deficit and also helps our employment, our revenue. It's a big gain for the American consumer.
What about the concern over potential environmental damage being done to underground water, being done to communities where this kind of drilling for gas has taken place?
Well, I can tell you the hydraulic fracturing that's going on in Pennsylvania, New York, and parts of West Virginia, that is a technology that has been in use for 60 years now in over 1.2 million wells, and there is no documented case of that technology resulting in pollution of any water. So this can be done safely. Now, of course, there's a lot of water used in the process. There's a lot going on. But in terms of the technology itself, there's a breakthrough in using hydraulic fracturing with horizontal drilling. And when we combine those two technologies, we can bring much more to the market than we ever thought possible. When they drill, they're drilling down thousands of feet generally, especially in Pennsylvania, below where the water of the aquifer is. There's cement casing. There's lots of regulations that actually look after that as well.
Stephen Power, what do we know about how safely this kind of fracturing can be done?
Well, the EPA, as Mr. Hayes was saying, is just beginning a study of that question to try to resolve this issue. On the issue of offshore drilling, there are a lot of well-established statistics that are somewhat overlooked in this debate. According to the U.S. Minerals Management Service, offshore operators produced 7 billion barrels of oil from 1985 to 2001 with a spill rate of only 0.001%. So the industry's overall safety record is very good. Now, if you ask environmental groups what they think of that, often what they'll say is that the risk of a spill, if you did have one, would be so great that it could be very harmful to a state's economy, to a tourism economy. And in some states, like Florida, a lot of the political leadership there, they look at Louisiana and Texas and say, well, we don't want an industrialized economy. We want a tourism-based economy, an economy driven by beaches and Walt Disney. But there is, however, the industry does have a point when it looks to some of these safety statistics.
Ethan?
Well, I still think, Stephen's right in that our big risk, we are worried about the risk of a catastrophic spill, but I think the routine pollution that comes from the operations is always a kind of undervalued. I moved here from Florida, and I know when we worked on this issue in Florida, states would often point to, Florida does not want to be like Louisiana and Texas with tar balls and the routine pollution that comes from the operation of rigs. And Stephen also mentioned the other worry that people have is the onshore development that would support the development of offshore drilling. So you see pumping stations and onshore facilities that would harm wetlands and other coastal resources. So the industrialization really is the issue. I think coastal states that have a huge tourism industry, like Florida, like New Jersey, don't want to see that kind of industrialization happen on their coast. And especially, again, that for us, the issue really is the trade-off. I mean, are we going to chase every barrel of oil, no matter what the price, or every cubic foot of natural gas, no matter what the cost to the environment, rather than innovate our way out of this problem with fuel economy standards, more energy efficiency, and renewable energy? Because we think the time now in our country has passed for looking backwards towards a fossil fuel-driven energy policy, and we should move forward on efficiency and renewables.
We have many callers. We'll open the phones now. First to Mike. He's in Big Rock, Illinois. Good morning to you, sir. You're on the air. Mike, you're on the air. Are you there? I'm afraid we'll have to come back to Mike. Let's go to Jeremy in Virginia Beach. Good morning.
Good morning. Great show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to say that traditionally I've usually always been on the side of the environmentalist and have cringed at the thought of offshore drilling and these kind of fossil fuel developments here in the U.S. But I can see the importance of this as a sort of an olive branch to the Republican Party, to the right. And I think it's important and it's actually a good thing to sort of do this to say, you know, hey, look, this is something traditionally that the Democrats and the president may not have been the most keen on. But after everything that's happened in the past year, we still want to move forward. We want, you know, bilateral support. We're willing to make concessions to let that happen. And I think it's a good leadership move.
Do you agree, Stephen?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how the Republican reaction sort of plays out. I thought that one thing that was interesting in the reaction to yesterday's announcement was sort of the disconnect between what the oil and gas groups tended to be saying about the announcement and what the Republican leadership was saying about it. Often there is an overlap in what those two groups tend to say about oil policy. But yesterday, the major oil-related trade groups, including the American Petroleum Institute, had pretty positive things to say. And that's pretty remarkable because that group has not at all been shy about criticizing what it sees as flaws in the administration's energy policy. But they yesterday were saying this is a positive step in the right direction. But over on the Republican side, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the House Republican Leader John Boehner were both very quick out of the box to issue statements that condemned the president's announcement, said it didn't go far enough, still left lots of offshore oil and gas under lock and key. And so it was sort of an interesting disconnect. There are some Republicans who have said positive things, but it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Stephen Bauer, The Wall Street Journal, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to you, Rael, going far but not far enough?
I think it's a great first step forward.
And first step.
Right. I mean, we it is true. We do have many more resources available to us if we choose to go for them, not just in these areas, but off the coast of California, for example. And they've been at it for a long time now, since the 19th century. So we do have more resources. So that point is well taken by some of our representatives. But we are happy to see progress being made. We're happy to realize that this is going to be a positive step for the American people. We're going to have more energy, and we're looking forward to working with the administration to see this through and make sure that we, especially the Eastern Gulf, that we are able to bring that to the table sooner than later.
Let's go to South Bend, Indiana. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Thanks. I worked very hard for Barack Obama in Indiana, helped walk precincts, turned it blue basically in the last election or voted for him. And I'm very, very disappointed in this. I think that I don't understand the political calculus. I think that the trade-off is too great. And I think that in some sense he's abandoning the base and of the Democratic Party and others who have worked for him in this sort of phantom attempt to get Republican votes. And I would say if there is going to be a trade-off or if there's a political calculation, then I'd like to hear the American Petroleum Institute representatives say that they will support climate change legislation, say, reducing emissions 20% by 2020, and then that might be a reasonable approach. But all I hear is that they'll support energy policy. And I'd like to ask her, will the API support aggressive and assertive climate change reductions or reductions in greenhouse gases in response to this?
This is not an either-or to us. These are two separate issues. We're looking at trying to move forward with developing as many resources as we can in the United States. We don't want to take anything off the table. And the truth is the vast majority of Americans support the development of oil and natural gas resources. We have a proven track record in that development. Offshore and onshore, we have the technology, we have the rules and regulations moving forward, and this is not mutually exclusive.
Ethan.
Well, it is actually kind of either or, though, because the president would not have put this on the table if he wasn't trying to get a climate bill passed. So it would be significant if API did support the overall goals of this climate bill, which is a 17% reduction of emissions and a cap on and a price on carbon. So that would be because it is in the context of this bill that we're dealing with. That's the real politic that we've got to deal with here in Washington.
We have not seen the bill yet, so I cannot say that our industry would support it or not. We have not seen the final bill.
Well, so it's a follow-up call opportunity, which is good.
But, you know, I understand Steve's disappointment, mm-hmm. his yeah. anger, because it would have seemed during the campaign that there was a far more nuanced approach to this issue.
No, you're right. We were disappointed as well, I mean, by the announcement, because it was, we think, a bit of an overreach. It was an aggressive move to increase drilling here in the United States. And it was different from what he had what the president had done as a senator and what he supported for a long time in terms of having opposing drilling up until near the end of the campaign. I mean, the interesting thing about Drill Baby Drill is that for all the noise it made, none of those candidates won. And I think that underscores how what the public really wants, I think, is more of a comprehensive energy approach that looks forward.
Would the Sierra Club and other environmental groups understand and be satisfied with a compromise that would allow the climate change bill to go forward?
Well, I think I think at the end of the day, we will be very practical. And if we want to get a climate bill passed, we want to see the cap on carbon, we want to see the reduction of emissions. We'd like to scale back this drilling, though, and that'll be our first issue of business on the Senate side, is to limit this drilling as this bill goes forward.
Ethan Manuel, he's Director of Lands Protection Program at the Sierra Club. When we come back, more of your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org, and by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
How a handful of American banks gained unprecedented wealth and threatened the well-being of the nation. A leading economist on what led to the meltdown and why big financial institutions should be allowed to fail. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back talking about the president's decision announced yesterday to allow some offshore drilling. As you can imagine, there have been lots of reactions and responses to that decision. Earlier in the program, you heard from the Deputy Secretary of the Department of the Interior, David Hayes. Now we have three people with us. Stephen Power of the Wall Street Journal, Rayola Dewar of the American Petroleum Institute, and Ethan Manuel of the Sierra Club. Here's an email from Robert, who's in Lakewood, Ohio. What are the chances President Obama will get any concessions from Republicans on a climate change bill now that he's given away his best bargaining chip, allowing offshore drilling in offshore areas previously off limits? Hasn't he learned from the healthcare debate, Stephen Power?
I think it's possible that he'll get some additional Republican support for this based on some of the comments that were heard yesterday from some Republicans who did have some favorable things to say about it. But Another obstacle that he's running up against on climate legislation is simply time. I mean, he's eaten through, or Congress has eaten through, roughly two-thirds of its legislative calendar. There's not that much time left to debate this issue on the Senate side. The bill has not even been introduced, really, on the Senate side, the one that's going to be the template for this debate. He wants to pass a bill to overhaul the financial regulations, and he also wants to revise No Child Left Behind. These are all things that are going to eat up more time. I think the clock is ticking.
Ethan, you mentioned that yesterday or in this morning's Post, looks as though Judd Gregg may be shifting his allegiance here.
No, I think the president is hoping that this announcement wouldn't jar loose a few Republican votes on the Senate side, and Judd Gregg seemed to be back in play when you look at the Post article. I think that's going to be where the president's going to look, is the two senators from Maine, some other moderates like Judd Gregg, who hopefully are in play as part of the climate bill debate.
All right. To Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, Rod. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I wanted to take issue with something that the lady from the petroleum industry said about hydraulic fracturing, and I don't want people to misconstrue what she said about the safety of hydraulic fracturing. And she said that there's no documented evidence of the ill effects of hydraulic fracturing. Well, I'd just like to say, in Arkansas, we drilled some 2,000-3,000 wells without even hiring an inspector to look over the process by the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality. I spent a good portion of last year lobbying our state legislature about this very issue, trying to tell them about the dangers of hydraulic fracturing that are just starting to emerge in states like Colorado. It takes a while for the effects of it to be seen. Well, the governor of Arkansas nominated pretty much an attorney to head the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, and they did not put in the infrastructure on the front end. It's like a gold rush. They do not know the effects of this kind of impact on these areas. And I fear for the long-term futures of water quality. And I would just like to hear a little more discussion about what hasn't been done to put in environmental infrastructure regarding it. Here, the tax that they put on the drilling went straight to the highway department. There's been literally no environmental regulations of it whatsoever, and it was exempted federally from the Safe Drinking Water Act.
All right. Ethan, can you comment?
Well, I think he hit the nail on the head. The big concern with this issue is water quality, especially in the West, where there's limited amounts of water, and you do need to inject quite a bit of water into this process. And so I think it gets to the larger point of, are we that desperate to find every single piece of fossil fuel we can that we will do anything, including threatening water quality in some of these areas, just to find more resources when we could do a lot more on conservation and renewables and energy efficiency to reduce our demand? And that's where I think we save money for consumers, we wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, and we don't put ourselves in these predicaments where we threaten other resources while we're looking for fossil fuels.
Now, Stephen Power, the question of, have there been any documented cases of water being affected by this fracturing process? Do we know that yet?
I don't know enough about this topic to really assess that, but I know that the EPA is just beginning work on a study to examine just this question: what are the risks? What is the documented evidence of it? The issue, as the caller was saying, is that at the federal level, this really has not been something that's been regulated and overseen. It's something that's left to the states, so that's why we perhaps don't have maybe the most comprehensive information that policymakers.
So that's yet to come, Rayola.
Now the head of EPA's water quality just a few weeks ago said the same thing, that he knows of no case in the history of hydraulic fracture.
They have not done this.
No, they did a study 4 years ago and
came
up with the same conclusion.
4 years ago.
No, they don't have any, we don't have any documented cases. Now, there are, of course, there are things that go on around the development of any oil and gas rig. There's water that you have to manage, that is managed, that is over, states have the regulatory, most states have the regulatory primacy to be looking at this. But they have to follow the Clean Water Act. They have to do all of these things. And there are regulations in place. For the disposal of the water, you need permits, you need all sorts of things to move forward. So this is not a haphazard process. You can have a spill of the wastewater. Things can happen. But the hydraulic fracturing, the technology itself, with the well casing, with the cementing, is safe and has been proven safe for many years.
I think in the programs that we've had on this very subject, we've heard from a great many people around the country living in communities where this fracturing is taking place who have reported toxic elements in the drinking water. So clearly, a great deal more investigation needs to be done on this, Ethan.
No, I think you're right. I think Stephen hit the nail on the head. This is an issue that during the Bush administration, I think, wasn't really studied from a federal level. And the Obama administration rightfully will start looking at this in a more aggressive way because the information is not out there, like you said.
All right, to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Christian. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, what is the administration's current official position on climate change following the bit of controversy that occurred recently regarding the science? I know the science is there. There are data and a few scientists who made errors does not nullify the entire science behind what's happening.
All right, Ethan.
Well, I think on climate change, yeah, the administration's against it. They want to fight it. And I think I think when you look at everything the administration is doing, they're taking it seriously, whether it's supporting a climate bill that puts a cap on carbon and reduces emissions to the way they manage the land. I mean, Secretary Hayes has been doing a great job, as has Secretary Salazar at the Department of Interior, managing public lands for the impacts of climate change. And so throughout the administration, even Department of Defense, Department of Interior, and legislatively, the Obama administration understands the challenges faced that we're facing from climate change and are taking them quite seriously.
Here's an email from Kevin in Baltimore. If we do find sufficient oil here in the U.S., where will it be refined? The people who live in and around Port Arthur, Texas, suffer from numerous health problems associated with the refining of oil. I'll wager none of your listeners would want a refinery in their backyard. We have technology to get our energy from clean and renewable sources. Why are we still looking for oil? Rayola.
Because we're going to need it. We do have options in terms of renewables. We are investing, actually as an industry, we invest more than I'm aware of any other industry, $58 billion, one out of every $5 being spent in the United States on wind, solar, geothermal renewables is being spent by the oil and natural gas industry. But the truth is we're starting from such a small base. It's going to take many, many years to ramp up. When you look at wind, solar, geothermal, they account for less than 1% of U.S. energy use. So when you hear folks talking about doubling, quadrupling, increasing it, we'll get to 3%, 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%. We need a heck of a lot more than that. And as an industry, we're saying, bring it on. We need it all. We're very supportive of these other alternative fuels, but we're also very supportive of developing U.S. resources. Oil, natural gas, we can do it, and we've proven we can do it safely.
Ethan.
But when you look at offshore drilling, especially with oil, I mean, most of that, almost all of that goes to transportation. And the and EPA estimates that we can reduce our demand by 7 million barrels a day, which is over a third, just by using existing technologies.
What about the effects, the impact of refining oil, as our caller has raised?
Well, he raises an interesting issue because the refining capacity in the United States is pretty maxed out. I think most refineries are operating at 98-99% capacity. And because of opposition from neighbors who don't want to have that who don't want to live near a refinery, and the fact that the companies like operating at 99% capacity, there hasn't been new refineries built anywhere in the United States,
and
I think, recently. So
here's an email on that very subject. Tao in Hillsboro, Texas says, I understand there's a shortage and bottleneck of oil refinery capacity in the U.S. How can an increase in domestic oil production decrease the dependency on foreign oil, since we have to send oil overseas to be refined and then re-import it again? Stephen.
Well, on this question, there are a lot of facts that sometimes get overlooked. According to the Energy Information Administration, access to the Pacific, Atlantic, and Eastern Gulf regions would not have a significant impact on domestic crude oil and natural gas or prices before 2030. Now, that's not necessarily an argument against drilling. There are other arguments for increased drilling. One of them is just to reduce the trade deficit. Another is just to increase jobs. But I think something that sometimes gets lost in this discussion is when we think about the whole quest for energy independence or energy security or whatever you want to call it, we think a lot about the Persian Gulf and our dependence on those countries. But the Middle East actually supplies only 11% of U.S. oil needs. Canada and Mexico are the leading sources of our crude oil. And whether you think that the share that we get from the Middle East is too large or too small, there is some economic rationale to getting at least some oil from that region, because the Persian Gulf countries are the world's lowest cost producers.
So you're saying we're not pulling up oil in this country, sending it abroad to be refined?
Well,
right.
it's a globally traded commodity, and that's what determines the price. And so to some extent, the idea that we're going to be able to control the energy price situation in our country through more domestic production is a little overstated. I'll give you one fact point. If you look at the United Kingdom, which has been self-sufficient in oil since 1980, if you chart it, the price of oil in the United Kingdom, and if you chart the price of oil in the United States over time, you'll see that the ups and downs are almost perfectly in sync. And so what I think that shows is that it is a globally traded commodity. The price of oil is set around the world just by the normal workings of supply and demand. Even if we do produce more of our own oil and say we're not going to take any from abroad, well, first of all, it's unlikely we could do that. But then secondly, China, their economy is growing. They're going to want more oil. So the idea that we can really influence these prices ourselves is a little misconstrued.
Stephen Power, The Wall Street Journal. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Debbie in Indianapolis. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I want to reach back to a couple callers before, and I think a comment that Stephen or one of your guests made about Barack Obama's decision to support this kind of offshore drilling as being a leadership role. And then the person from Indiana who was a Barack supporter saying, oh, I'm so disappointed or angry. I too worked here in Indiana to turn this state, and I continue to support him. I think that he is showing great leadership. I think he tries to reach beyond traditional boundaries to build coalitions and networks to support a greater good, a common good. And, you know, what we can say in the abstract, that when you get into the nitty-gritty detail and the complexity of these issues, it really does get nuanced. And I think he is a president who understands nuances. He understands building coalitions. And so I just really hope that the Barack supporters continue to back him to understand that it's complex, and we need allies on every side of the fence.
Debbie, thanks for calling. Ethan.
Well, I think she's right. I mean, the president is making an honest attempt to build a bipartisan climate bill. But the unfortunate thing is the Republicans haven't really been as willing to do a bipartisan approach as he has. And clearly, by putting this on the table, he wants to reach out to the Republicans, and so far he hasn't gotten a reciprocal response.
Yeah, I mean, the Republicans are digging in by and large, pretty hard against his climate agenda. And what's somewhat striking is that even Republicans who in the past have supported proposals to put a price on carbon are digging in against him. John McCain is the most obvious example. Senator McCain, for years, was a loner in his party on this issue, pushing legislation to put a price on carbon. Now he's saying he will not support the president's plan. He has cited the president's policies on nuclear, says that they're not sufficiently helpful to the nuclear industry, but at the same time, the senator has a challenger on his right flank from J.D. Hayworth back in Arizona. So there's a little bit of politics going on there. I think that it is going to be hard for the president to get a lot of Republican votes, but we'll see in the weeks ahead.
So, do you think that this decision could make a difference in gleaning support for his climate change bill?
I think it does. I mean, I think it does put it is, like Stephen said earlier, the Republicans putting the ball in their court, saying, listen, you've got to either put up or shut up. Are you going to be a statesman and work with me on a very important piece of legislation, or are you going to just take your ball and go home?
Ethan Manuel of the Sierra Club, Stephen Power of the Wall Street Journal, Rayola Dewar of the American Petroleum Institute. Well, we shall see where this goes. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.